This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Governor Ron DeSantis wants to pay beginning teachers more. DeSantis unveiled a proposal this week to make the starting salary $47,500. That's a $10,000 increase on what beginning teachers make now, according to the National Education Association. But can Governor Ron DeSantis deliver on his pitch to boost the pay of Florida teachers? Where is that money going to come from, and what kind of political buy-in does DeSantis have? We'll talk about how to make that plan a reality, but first, let's hear from a teacher. Max Sensipa teaches AP Calculus at Apopka High School. Well, Max, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be on the show.
The governor, Ron DeSantis, has come out in the last day or so and said that he would like to see starting teacher salaries boosted by about $10,000 up to the $47,500 range. What's your reaction to that announcement, that idea at least of trying to boost starting salaries for teachers?
Well, my reaction is going to be the reaction of a lot of teachers. We're all very happy to get any sort of raise nowadays. As a younger teacher, it'll certainly be a large raise for me, but some of the older teachers are going to be very concerned about how they're going to be differentiated. We typically get a percentage raise every year, and if our salaries are raised up to, I believe it was 47,500, a lot of the older teachers will be making just as much if there isn't anything done for them.
When you were thinking about becoming a teacher, did you think about salary, or was it more just about this is the career I want, this is like a calling for me?
I think a lot of teachers choose it because of the calling, but I'll be honest, there was a bonus I got in my salary that was part of what enticed me. What was the former best and brightest bonus really did help me make the plunge as a teacher.
How do you and your colleagues feel about bonuses? It must be nice having some extra money, but is that the best way to go about recognizing good teachers and compensating them for it?
Well, I believe that we're really discussing two different problems here. One is basic teacher pay, which I and a lot of my colleagues, we're all on pretty much unanimous agreement. Of course, some will always disagree, but there's general agreement that salaries need to be raised. However, you're right, the bonuses are quite contentious. I come down in favor of some sort of bonus for either high-performing teachers or even more so for teachers in very demanded-for subjects. As you might know, we currently have a pretty major teacher shortage in mathematics right now, especially for 6th through 12th. That's the higher-level courses. Part of the reason I took up teaching was because of the bonus that I got for those. I used to get about a $7,000 bonus. Because of that, that's been taken away and replaced with a rather smaller one.
I'm also curious to know, I mean, you're in your third year as a teacher. Are you still kind of satisfied with the career choice you've made? Do you have second thoughts at any point? And I'm wondering, too, about teachers that you started out with. Have you seen some of the folks that started teaching with you drop out and move to other careers?
As far as, to answer your first question, I love the job. The job itself, the work, you either love it or hate it, and I love it. I really do love helping kids learn. So that's not something that I'm worried about being burned out by any time soon. But with regards to my peers, we've seen, I can speak for my high school at least, we've seen a fairly large amount of churn. Teachers not necessarily quitting the teaching profession, but moving on to teach either elementary or moving on to go back to school and perhaps teach another day, perhaps not. But yeah, that's been a struggle for a lot of us.
Well, Max, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
No problem at all.
Max Sensipa teaches AP Calculus at Apopka High School. We turn now to whether the proposal to raise starting salaries for teachers can become a reality. Cassidy Alexander covers education for the Daytona Beach News Journal. Cassidy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joined by Frank Torres. He's a Republican political analyst. Thank you again, Frank.
Thank you.
And Dick Batchelor, Democratic political analyst. Thanks again, Dick.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Cassidy, I want to start with you. Announcing plans to pay teachers more from the get-go should be a pretty big deal, but I'm just wondering what the response is so far from teachers. How are teachers that you've talked to reacting to this?
Well, I think, first of all, teachers are thankful for the recognition that they need to be paid more. But mostly what I've heard from them is a lot of questions. They're kind of hesitant to lean into this with open arms because there is so much they don't know. I'm hearing a lot of people asking, is this going to be sustainable? Like, if this comes to fruition, is this going to be a one-year thing or is it going to be forevermore? How are lawmakers going to account for veteran teachers who are maybe making similar amounts to what they propose now, who, if this proposal goes through, would be making the same as starting teachers. What's going to happen with them? And also, where is this money going to come from? I mean, that's a lot of money, and they're a little bit hesitant to, again, accept it if they are going to lose money for other things in public education.
Mm-hmm. Right, so a bit of a wait-and-see approach. And I guess this isn't the first time that something like this has been suggested. I wonder, just for the benefit of our listeners, Cassidy, if you could kind of give us some background on the kind of challenges that Volusia County is facing, because as many school districts do, Volusia County has some hurdles to overcome. And one of the things that you've been reporting on is vacant teacher positions that the district has to fill. Could something like what the governor is proposing go a ways towards fixing the issue of trying to hire the teachers that Volusia County needs?
I think that what teachers would say is that there isn't going to be a quick fix to something like the shortage of teachers, particularly in Volusia. Of course, money is an issue, but a lot of it comes down to trust and respect. And I think teachers will say that this raising the starting pay is a step in the right direction toward raising the value that we in Florida put on teachers. But I don't think that that's going to be a cure-all for some of the problems that they're having in public education.
Mm-hmm. And is pay something that comes up when you talk to teachers about, you know, why they may be unhappy with the situation they find themselves in or other concerns they might have about the profession in general?
Definitely, yeah. It just kind of comes down to teachers feeling undervalued, and pay is a pretty obvious way to show that you value your employees in any profession. But teachers, yeah, they definitely are. They need more money, and it's not just what they make in their salaries either. Of course, they have consistent concerns with how the legislature funds public education and how they often put mandates on school districts and on teachers that don't come with any money to support it.
When you talk to teachers who may be thinking of quitting or going elsewhere, where are they going? Are they going to other school districts that offer better benefits or better pay, or are they just getting out of the profession altogether?
It's kind of hard. I think a lot of times it comes down to what people, it's like a personal situation. Like sometimes people will go to nearby counties. Sometimes they'll leave the profession. Sometimes they'll go, and do something else. Teachers' unions, I hear a lot of them talking, especially in Volusia, talking about how they are losing teachers to other school districts. I don't have any information, like hard data, to kind of support that. So I would be hesitant to make any claims about, of course, people are like fleeing certain counties that pay their teachers less.
We're talking to Cassidy Alexander. She's an education reporter for the Daytona Beach News Journal, talking about the idea of raising starting salaries for teachers, at least. Cassidy, stay with us if you wouldn't mind. And I want to bring Dick Batchelor and Frank Torres into this conversation. Dick Batchelor, a Democratic political commentator. Frank Torres, Republican political commentator. Frank, I mean, it seems like a plan like this would have a lot of support, but what about the fine print? Cassidy mentioned the money it's going to cost. Governor DeSantis saying he'd like an extra $600 million. What are lawmakers saying about that? Are they saying, yep, that's fine? Or are they thinking we're going to have to do some Tetris to figure things out here?
Yeah, everything Cassidy said was pretty accurate. But what's frustrating me at this point is we're at the announcement phase. I mean, this announcement's, you know, still very new, and we're still a couple of months away from session. Now, if you've been following this for a while, you know that when legislation or any sort of bills, when they start from the announcement phase, from the press conference, they can look completely different by the time they pass. Both chambers have to, you know, have to mess around with it. There's going to be a lot of debates. But I think it's a move in the right direction. As far as what I believe the average person in the state believes, I think if you ask the average man or woman on the street, hey, do you think our teachers, our public school teachers, are being paid well enough? They would probably tell you no. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm optimistic at the track we're heading down, but a little aggravated at the response and the skepticism involved. But I guess, hey, that's just the environment these days.
Dick Batchelor, do you kind of look at this with a slightly skeptical eye?
I think a qualifying eye. I think Cassidy made some points in her interviews with some of the teachers. You know, first of all, the governor's to be applauded, not to make him nervous as a Democrat, for proposing $630 million, because historically the leadership in the House and the Senate, Republican-led leadership, has increased the base student allocation or per FTE allocation by about $2 mm-hmm. per student per year. So this is a giant step, I think, in addressing parity when it comes to paying teachers what should be a fair wage. But I think Frank made a point, too. It's early on. Now, the Senate President Galvano seems to be behind it. But if you go back and read what the Speaker of the House, Oliva, said, he said, well, the governor's already asked for $2 billion in new money. Mm-hmm. The revenue estimated conference only adds up by a few hundred million dollars. Where is it coming from? So it is early in the game. I applaud the governor for announcing it. He's kind of put a stake in the ground to say teacher pay is very important and needs to raise. But now it'll be in the details.
Mm-hmm. Does it kind of surprise you a little bit, given what we've heard and seen from the governor so far in his approach to education, like yep. coming out at this point saying, I want to raise the salaries of starting teachers? I mean, is that a surprise to you?
That he wants to raise it that much in one quantum leap does surprise me. But again, I think, where are you taking the money from?
Mm-hmm.
If you're asking for $2 billion as the governor, new money in the budget, where are you taking that money from? For instance, you have what they call FEFP, Florida Education Finance Plan. I hate to bore you with this, but it's important, and based on an allocation. Now, will they go tick around with the funding for me in other areas that's loosened up money for teacher salary increases? So there's some healthy skepticism is merited here. And frankly, what about the base student allocation? Where are you taking this money from?
Mm-hmm.
And again, keep in mind, too, that the legislature, Republican legislature, has from time to time basically restricted the amount of money that school boards can raise locally and reduce the required local effort. So there's always ways to play with the funding to get the $600 million, but it is not going to be a written check and walk away. The legislature will tease this thing apart, I think, mightily.
Frank Torres, could you see other programs being cut to accommodate a $600 million ask for some kind of project like this?
Well, I think everything's going to get reviewed. And if you're saying, hey, Frank, you're putting me on the spot, where's this thing going to land off of what I know just off the basis of an announcement? I would say it's probably going to land somewhere between the governor's goal and where we're at now, maybe even a little bit less. This is meant to be a starting point to move us in the right direction. And I think maybe the governor himself could have been a little bit more forward about that, saying, hey, you know, our lawmakers, our representative of elective representatives from all over the state have to look at this as well. Maybe take it from a little bit more grounded approach. But, you know, we're just going to wait to see how it shakes up. I can tell you we're moving into an election year,
mm-hmm.
and any lawmakers that are voting against an increase for our teachers are going to have that thrown in their face on a mailer come re-election next fall.
And I think, too, as you look at this, where is the money coming from is a very important question. But I think from a business standpoint, back up and look, you've got turnover. So one factor could be salary benefits.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a very high turnover, first year turnover, and somebody can correct me, it's probably about 25%.
It's bad, yeah.
So what is causing that turnover? How do you retain those teachers? So maybe it's salary benefits, but it might be something else, ongoing training, maybe more qualifications to get in the classroom. So if you get at the 25% turnover, the ballpark figure,
mm-hmm.
as we know, it costs about 30% to rehire. So if you take 25% turnover and apply a 30% factor to rehire, you're spending hundreds of millions of dollars right there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I would behoove the legislature to look beyond the salary and benefit package on the retention side and also the reward of the teachers that have been there for a long time who are not new in the profession. But the last thing you want to do is give a teacher an increase and they're now at $50,000. I've been there for 10 years. I'm at $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be some dissension there. So there's a lot of elements to this. They need to dive down from, I always call it a business approach, and look at what's causing the real escalating cost.
Cassidy, if I could bring you back into this conversation, that seems to speak to a little bit of what you were alluding to when you said that's one of the questions that teachers and unions have. What about the teachers who've been in the system for a while? Because retention is pretty critical, right? And making sure that senior teachers who've spent a lot of time at their craft, they're good teachers, they stick around. The state of Florida is going to have to figure out how to accomplish that if they do end up raising those starting salaries.
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of what the governor's proposal is about is trying to get new teachers in. But as I said, it kind of always goes back when I'm talking to teachers to this issue of respect and of feeling undervalued. And the veteran teachers are the ones who are having those feelings. And I don't think that suddenly working a teacher who has 30 years of experience, suddenly working with a teacher who just came out of college, who's making the same amount of money that they are, is going to sit very well with them. And I also neglected to mention, but as I've been talking to teachers, they've been asking too, what about the support staff? What about the office specialists, the paraprofessionals, the bus drivers, all those other people who make public education happen who are not included in this.
Mm-hmm. What about retention, too, that Dick Batchelor was talking about? Can you give us any sense of what the turnover rate is like for new teachers who do make a start in Volusia County schools?
I can't speak off the top of my head to new teachers specifically, but I know that Volusia's rate, they have like an 85% retention rate, which means every year about 15% of teachers do not come back for the next year. Mm-hmm. And they have about 4,500, 4,300 teachers. So if you can do the math real quick there, that'll tell you how many people it is.
Yeah, and let me tell you, jumping in real quick, there are people in school right now, in college, getting an education degree that are going out on their internships. They're looking at the environment and they're saying, you know what? These conditions are not favorable. I'm going to go back and study something else. So it's not just a retention problem or getting people hired. It's getting them to go through the actual education process to make them want to be teachers mm-hmm. because the conditions are so rough out there.
Can the legislature actually set teacher pay, Frank Torres? I wonder if we should be reframing the conversation a bit.
To set teacher pay?
Mm.
Well, I mean, that's a long process to go. I mean, we're already heading down this one track to see where we're headed. But I think moving into the legislative session with the conversation being opened this way and everybody having their antennas up, we're just going to have to wait and see.
If you compare Orange County right now, they're negotiating with their bargaining agent, the teachers union.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
You know, they're trying to get maybe a $2,500 increase, maybe a $1,000 bonus, and they don't want bonuses, they want a salary increase. But you have the collective bargaining unit's role to play. A legislature could allocate K-12 $630 million. That would so it would become your new starting point for negotiation with your teachers. Well, let me tell you what the Democrats are going to offer on the table. You've got the corporate tax benefit, right? That's for private school scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to say, what about that $1 billion? You know, that Speaker Corcoran, who's now the Commissioner of Education, has really had removed from the budget. So why not put some of that money on the table to fund public education? So the whole education thing, I think, is going to be mired up in the public-private sector approach and then also the tax credit approach with the scholarship funds. Mm-hmm. And by the way, are you going to now defund things in upper education like Bright Futures?
Right.
Or where's the money coming from? So if you do away with Bright Futures, that's not a good thing to incent people to go to college. They can't afford to go to college. So if you play the K-12 funding area, FEFP, but that doesn't mean you can't move money from higher education to K-12 and then fight over it there. So there are a lot of elements to it. I mean, the governor would like to say, I'm announcing $630 million.
Mm-hmm.
Average pay increase is going to go up $10,000. It's not that easy.
Right. Reality might be a little different. Frank Torres, what about Richard Corcoran? How does he factor into all of this?
I think his voice in this conversation is going to be really interesting because the same memo that Oliva sent out that was very cautious when addressing this the governor's proposal is the same kind you would have gotten when Corcoran was in the position.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, anybody who's in that position is going to be careful because they're managing so many members and there's a lot of money out there on the table. But we're going to have to wait to see, and that money is going to have to come from somewhere. I can tell you from a lot of the programs already under scrutiny, Visit Florida, some of the other programs out there that we've already heard of that have already had some controversial tie-ins, mm-hmm. they're going to be under a lot of pressure to pull any possible penny they can to go towards this initiative.
Did you say Common Core?
And education is a pretty mighty chunk of the state budget year in, year out, isn't it?
Yeah.
At the background to this, too, of course, there's also the issue of the Best and Brightest program, the teacher bonus system, and you have Senator Rob Bradley proposing to actually do away with that altogether. What do you make of that?
I think a lot of people were unhappy with the metrics behind it, how it was determined, saying that certain classrooms, especially some with more Hispanic-heavy classrooms or classrooms with different operations, made a lot of the teachers unhappy. So I think that's going to be another branch of this education conversation where we try to implement something, you know, along those lines.
And in fact, there's a lawsuit
that's correct.
Right now.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, Cassidy Alexander, how that sort of plays into what you're hearing from teachers. How do they feel about a bonus program like the Best and Brightest? Are teachers that you talk to, would they be unhappy about that program going away if there's some other way of recognizing the work that teachers do?
I don't think that you're ever going to hear any teachers saying, no, I don't want that money. But I think that they don't, as a whole, teachers don't want bonuses. They want money that is going to be recurring. They want raises that they can depend on every single year. And we talked about that a little bit already, but the contract negotiations going on in Orange County, they don't want to see bonuses. They didn't want to see it in Volusia either. They want to see raises. They want that commitment. And that's what they're so worried about with this, with the governor's proposal, because there isn't anything really firm here that they can hold on to still.
Well, Cassidy Alexander covers education for the Daytona Beach News Journal. Thank you so much for joining us, Cassidy.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Frank Torres, Republican political analyst. Thank you so much, Frank.
Anytime.
And Dick Batchelor, Democratic political analyst. Thank you, Dick.
Let me just say the Democrat and Republicans need to do homework and hope the dog doesn't eat the governor's homework.
Up next, jury selection is underway in the first of two murder trials for Markeith Lloyd. He's accused of killing his ex-girlfriend Sade Dixon in 2016, and he's also charged with the murder of Orlando police officer Deborah Clayton in 2017. And that killing sparked a nine-day manhunt. We'll talk to Orlando Sentinel Courts reporter Monavette Cordero about the case and the process of selecting a jury from a pool of 2,000 people. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Markeith Lloyd is on trial for the murder of Sade Dixon, his ex-girlfriend who was pregnant when he allegedly killed her. Lloyd fled after the December 2016 killing. In January the next year, police say he shot and killed Police Lieutenant Deborah Clayton in a Walmart parking lot, and that sparked a nine-day manhunt and an arrest in which Lloyd lost an eye. Joining us to talk about the trial is Orlando Sentinel court reporter Monavette Cordero. Thanks, Monavette.
Thank you.
So, talk to us about the charges facing Markeith Lloyd. What is he facing here?
Yeah, so he's facing a count of first-degree murder in the killing of Sade Dixon, as well as charges of killing an unborn child by injury to the mother, attempted first-degree murder for critically injuring Dixon's brother, and attempted felony murder for shooting at Dixon's mother and her other brother. And those are just the charges Lloyd's facing in the Dixon trial. He's also facing first-degree murder in a second trial for the killing of Orlando Police Lieutenant Deborah Clayton. But that trial won't start until 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's convicted, Lloyd could face the death penalty.
What has happened so far? They started jury selection, and they're still going to be continuing with that for some time?
Yeah, so in all, about 2,000 people are going to be summoned for this case in the next several weeks, which is a lot. The 12-person jury, whenever they're chosen, is going to be sequestered in a hotel for the duration of the trial, which is expected to take 2 to 3 weeks. So the judge asked these panels questions about hardship and whether they could stay in a hotel for that amount of time.
2,000 potential jurors sounds like an awfully large pool. Is this kind of unusual?
We're not sure if it's unusual. We asked the court that, they weren't able to tell us, but it certainly is a lot of people. And part of that has to do with the fact that there's been a lot of local and national media attention on this case since Lloyd was accused of shooting Clayton when she tried to arrest him. When Circuit Judge Leticia Marquez questioned the 50-person panels last week on whether they recognized Markeith Lloyd, over half of the panel usually raise their hands. So a lot of people in the community are or appear to be familiar with some aspects of this case. So that can make it harder to choose a jury who can be fair and impartial and consider all the facts in the case.
Right. And there was so much attention around that manhunt, right, because of what triggered it, the alleged shooting of Lieutenant Deborah Clayton and the 9 days that followed. I mean, the city was kind of on edge for that time. So hard to really, I would think, find people who don't have some familiarity with, if not the killing of Sade Dixon, at least the death of Lieutenant Deborah Clayton.
Right, and finding not only jurors who, you know, can be impartial, even if they may have heard of the shooting, can be impartial to Lloyd and fair in the Dixon trial.
And I read that jury selection could actually end up taking longer than the trial itself. So that's kind of a pretty heavy lift for the first part of the trial, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So about 500 jurors are essentially being called every week for the next 3 to 4 weeks. And for the duration of the week, they're going to be, you know, questioned on, you know, their feelings on the death penalty, their exposure to the case, and things like that. The jury's recommendation for death has to be unanimous. So Lloyd's defense attorney, Terrence Lenneman, asked jurors if they would be able to, you know, be that one person who votes for life, or stop other jurors from bullying someone as they're, you know, considering the verdict. Lindemann asks jurors what kind of other mitigating factors they would consider when weighing the death penalty, like mental illness, trauma, and even racism. Lindemann said racism affected Lloyd, who is African-American, and asked at least one juror whether she thought racism exists in this country today. And in regards to, you know, how much they'll be able to hear about Clayton and the shooting there, jurors will only be allowed to hear that Lloyd shot at Clayton, but not that she was injured or died as a result of the shooting. And that's an effort to keep both trials as separate as they can.
Do you know how big is the pool of reserve jurors going to be? Because they often have that for a trial, right, in case somebody has to dip out halfway through.
Yeah, it depends largely on the attorneys and who it comes down to at the end. I know for the Miller trial, the Everett Miller trial, who was the Marine Corps veteran who was ultimately found guilty of killing two police officers in Kissimmee, there were about four alternate jurors in that case. But for the Scott Nelson trial earlier this year, there were less. So it just depends on the attorneys, really.
There's quite a lot going on with this case, too, because of some of the background to the state attorney's office around the time that Markeith Lloyd was arrested, right? I mean, because state attorney Aramis Ayala had come out publicly and said she did not believe in the death penalty. So this is kind of a case that goes to the heart of that whole debate as well. I imagine that's why some of those questions are coming up from the attorneys in the case.
Right, and they would usually come up for death penalty cases, but there is just more of a tension on this case because Orange Osceola State Attorney Aramis Ayala did take the opportunity to announce that she wasn't going to seek the death penalty with Lloyd's case. She specifically said that she wouldn't seek the death penalty in his case and in all other cases under her office. And after that, former Governor Rick Scott ultimately removed her from Lloyd's case and all these other death penalty cases and reassigned them to Ocala-based state attorney Brad King's office. And so his office is the one handling Lloyd's case.
As far as what we might hear from the defense once they get going, are you getting a sense of what that case might be just from the preliminary questions they're asking of jurors?
Yeah, we can tell just from the preliminary questions and also, you know, filings that they've had and even Lloyd's own comments in the past. He's claimed self-defense in regards to Dixon's killing. He says his ex-girlfriend armed herself with a gun that night and also claims her brother attacked him first before the shooting. Lloyd's belief, and this is something that his defense attorney said, that he has this belief that police wanted to kill him, and he said that a doctor was examining Lloyd to figure out if he was insane at the time that he shot Lieutenant Clayton because of this constant fear that police would kill him. And so that might come up during the phase when jurors consider the death penalty as a mitigating circumstance. Lindemann also asked jurors whether they would consider, you know, mental illness, trauma, and racism as mitigation. So that kind of gives us an insight into where they might be headed if he is convicted of the crime and ultimately goes on to that second phase of sentencing.
And what about the prosecution case? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so prosecutors will probably argue Lloyd killed his ex-girlfriend after he was upset with her for kind of going against his wishes by eating meat and smoking marijuana while pregnant. And this is, you know, stuff that he's claiming. Dixon had accused Lloyd of being abusive in the past and attempting to kill her by putting two guns to her head at one point. So prosecutors will probably also use texts between the two, including one text Lloyd sent Dixon minutes after she was pronounced dead, where he allegedly told her he hoped she wouldn't make it. So that's kind of where that's going.
And there has been a bit of uncertainty leading up to this trial about whether indeed Lloyd would have a lawyer, right? Because at one point he was going to represent himself. Where are we with that?
Right now he's being represented by Terrence Lindemann, and he's considered one of the best, if not the best, death penalty lawyer in Florida. He was previously represented by another attorney who the judge found was not death penalty qualified. And then before that, I think he wanted to represent himself. So it's been kind of a back and forth. But now and for months, Mr. Lindemann has been representing Lloyd.
All right. Well, Monavette Cordero is the Orlando Sentinel Courts reporter. She's covering the first of two murder trials for Markeith Lloyd. He's on trial at this point in time for the murder of Sade Dixon, his ex-girlfriend. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Up next, husband and wife singer-songwriters Jordan Wynn and Heather Lee are the driving force behind the band White Tigers. They join us on Intersection to play some songs and talk about their music. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. White Tigers are a husband and wife duo from Central Florida, Jordan Wynn and Heather Lee. They're performing as part of Immerse, the Creative City Project's art festival in downtown Orlando next week. They joined us in the WMFE studio to perform a couple songs and talk about their music. Here are White Tigers with a song called From the Inside. That's Jordan Wynn and Heather Lee, White Tigers, with a song called From the Inside. Jordan Wynn and Heather Lee are White Tigers. They have a kicking rhythm section, high-energy, joy-filled, groove-oriented group, the likes of which are deeply rooted in the R&B of the 60s, indie Americana at its most fun-filled finest. You're kind of drawing on a lot of different influences, and a lot of that comes out in your live performance. Tell us a little bit about your origin story. How did you meet? How did you get started?
Well, origin story... I was working at a coffee house. Mm-hmm. My bride picked me up.
Yeah.
Came in, said, I want to date you. I said, that sounds good. Let's do it. And then here we are 16 years later, you know, married. But we, musically, our origin story is I grew up playing Southern Rock. She grew up in a house listening to, well, you can say.
Pretty much R&B, 50s, 60s.
Yeah, oldies and Motown and stuff like that. And and so we had, in my house, Southern Rock and folk, like 70s folk. Paul Simon, James Taylor. And when we started playing together, we just, I mean, Heather's a great songwriter. And I'm very rhythm-centric. As a, originally a bass player, but you know, the Paul Simon from Graceland and on is our wheelhouse, like our favorite, with Wilco as well, and things like that, where it's tight drums but a lot of polyrhythms. And so we go for that kind of vibe rhythmically with uplifting sing-along style choruses. Well, yeah, hopefully folks can sing along with it, you know.
So do you always work with the same drummer?
No. No, we in studio we use lots of different drummers, actually. Live, we have a revolving cast. That's the great thing about being in Orlando is we do have access to some of the best, actually best rhythm players in, certainly in our area with Disney and Universal. So our drummers, we have several drummers who rotate in and out depending on what the show is and what the arrangements call for. But right now our two guys are, one's a Universal drummer and one's a Disney and SeaWorld style drummer. So they bring some cool stuff.
You've got two percussionists.
Two drummers, yeah.
Wow, like both on drum set?
Well, one on full kit and one on percussion, etc.
So we've had them both on both kits.
We have had them on both kit, two kits, like Allman Brothers or Tedeschi Truck style with two full drummers.
Which is fun.
How big is your band when you're performing live?
It depends on what the room allows, what the room calls for, where we're playing and how many. But at its biggest, we can have eight. At its smallest, we go out as a duo. But for a full band, quartet is what we can do quite a bit. But if we're playing something local that's a 200-person cap room, then we'll usually take five people.
In your eight-piece, does that include backing singers and the like?
Well, everybody in the band sings. So we don't have a only singer type deal. If they're going to sing, they're going to be playing something.
So we can add an extra keys person and somebody like that. Sometimes we'll do that.
Yeah. But, and even our drummers and percussion, I mean, they have vocal mics as well.
Do you ever do any a cappella stuff? No instruments?
Parts of songs are a cappella. The song that we just played, From the Inside, the outro of that in a live setting will have three-part harmonies a cappella for a while to engage and encourage folks to sing along.
Heather, are you the main songwriter in the duo here?
Yes, I pretty much write all of the songs and then bring it to the band, and then they kind of add their piece and part to it or change. A lot of times, you know, I'll get a song done, and it's like, well, what if we just change the whole rhythm? And I'm like, okay, well, whatever. You know, it's nothing so near and dear to my heart that it can't be changed or altered or anything like that to make it just more relatable for the band members and beyond.
And how do you come up with your ideas?
A lot of times I'm just driving down the road and things will come into my head and I'm like, I've got to remember this and just sing the same thing over and over again so that my children, they hear it and they are singing it back to me and it's wonderful because then I can get home and just play it on the piano. But a lot of times it's just sitting and just being in a space where, you know, I can just kind of let my mind hear a melody go and then just write some notes in my phone to get like a first verse and... That's kind of how it ends up.
Is your house a musical place? Like, are you surrounded by music all the time?
Like playing music? More Jordan than me. I don't listen to music.
Really?
I don't.
That's an interesting confession for a musician.
Well, it's because if I do start to listen to a lot of other like music, if I listen to bands and stuff, I'll start to get that sound in my head instead of just my own natural thing, you know? So the less I listen to music, I feel like the more original it is. But then it's funny because people will be like, you sound just like this person. And I'm like, well, I've never heard them. So that's cool. You know,
but I wonder if that's because whoever you sound like also listen to the same stuff you
sure,
did
growing
up.
And that's why there's definitely influences there. Or like he'll be like, you've got to listen to this band. So then I'll listen to them and I'll get really into it, you know, but, I just, for, as a
You're not as a practice music listener.
Yeah, yeah, right. No. But even as a practice, it's just like sitting in quiet, I think, gives my brain space to be able to come up with melodies or songs that if I had something kind of always going on that I wouldn't have that need or maybe the desire to as much. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Yeah, so you're an engaged listener. You can't just have something on while you're writing or whatever.
Right. Right.
What about you, Jordan?
Oh, I listen all incessantly. Yeah. I because I'm listening for studying. Yeah. I enjoy music as a casual listener, but more often than not, I'm listening because I'm dissecting. Mm-hmm. I really love the craft of musicianship.
Now, music is—it's not your only job, right? It's,
correct.
It's a obviously a passion, but sure. it's not the only thing. That...
Oh yeah, it's not the thing that puts the food on the table for our family. Yeah, we're contractors, general mm-hmm. contractors, air conditioning. We do historic home renovations, and you know, I'm like third generation contractor in mm-hmm. Orlando in Central Florida. So
what are you listening to while you're doing installations or renovations?
Well, most of the time I'm running the job, so I'm not listening to much during work because I'm watching my guys. But in driving or something like that, Paul Simon, mm-hmm. Wilco, really, really like Spoon a lot. Mm-hmm. We've liked them for 15 years, and they're just consistently solid. Mm-hmm. We were actually just in New York yesterday, but we went over the weekend to go see Wolfpack. They sold out Madison Square Garden, mm-hmm. so we flew up for that. And... yeah, I mean, anything with great rhythm is what I like.
You also write for ad campaigns and your music's used commercially. Tell me a little bit about what we might have heard. Like, what are some of your hits there?
Well, I mean, hits, you know, we do have a licensing deal to where Heather writes for a licensing company. And most of the stuff so far has been internet ads. There's mm-hmm. it's amazing to me the amount of just industry there is that I never ever deal with in my day to day. But a lot of our songs on record that we have are easy to sing along to and upbeat. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of wedding planners and wedding coordinators using our stuff for that.
And we just had the launch a new company, like a women's wellness company just had their brand launch using mm-hmm. one of our songs. Yeah. So that was pretty neat.
Great, yeah, because they're
very
actually...
Very woman empowerment, very... Yeah.
And they're associated with a great nonprofit that we're actually fans of, which was cool. It's cool, you know, when you have your stuff up for sale, you don't always get to pick who's purchasing it.
That must be interesting, because have you ever come across an internet ad with one of your songs and you're like, oh, I didn't realize that that's yes. what it was going to be used for?
Yes, mm-hmm. but we our contract, we do have the right to refuse. Mm. As long as it doesn't cross any heavy moral dilemmas in our life, we're like, well, I mean, hey, once we write a song and it's out there, it's anybody's anyways to choose what they want to do with it. Mm-hmm. As long as it's not in a film that we wouldn't want our kids to see,
sure.
then we pretty much grant everything, because then it's again paying for the food that our kids are eating, so why not? But we have it's pretty interesting. We've had stuff all over the world purchased. I mean, we what's cool is at the end of the month we get the breakdown as far as where it's been sold and what they're using it for. And you know, we're hoping to go do some European shows because our market over there is really doing well. Mm-hmm. So that would be great to go meet those folks and have an audience, because it was in a internet commercial or a brand launch commercial that's targeting Europe mm-hmm. that we would have never, ever known.
Heather, what would be the kind of apex of that? Would it be a TV show picking up a song or something?
Yes, a major brand, Coca-Cola, Target. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that would be good as far as financially. But I think it would be neat to probably have a movie or something like that, a series picking up songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you get to pitch to those kind of projects?
The company that we're with does it for us, mm-hmm. so we don't really do that personally.
Yeah, we do have local brands that we know personally that we're in talks with. But as far as on the national and international level, we just have no access to those buyers, those vendors. Mm-hmm. They all, you know, our management company, our label that we're with for that, they are the gatekeepers to mm-hmm. the industry of creative directors for film and, mm-hmm. and the like. So, But we do have some local stuff that I've personally been working on that hopefully we can have for 2020. That would be a lot of fun, especially since this is our home.
Heather, is it music with lyrics? What do they say? We just want this kind of vibe. Just write us a tune
they,
for
they
that.
They can pick. Mm-hmm. So we give it to them just as a music, and then we do it with a music with lyrics. And mm-hmm. for the most part, it's been a pretty balanced.
Yeah, it's about 60-40. Most mm-hmm. folks, they have the option when they purchase it, they get three basic versions of it. One with the full lyrics, one with just the music, and one with the background vocals as mm-hmm. well as the music. And by and large, 70% are using with the vocal take, because as you heard, and you know, Heather's stuff is just, her vocals are mm-hmm. notable. And the songs are great. So if it fits the campaign, most are attracted to the mm-hmm. vocal performance as well as the instrumentation.
You have a song, a new single out this week. Tell us about that.
Today is, it's a fun song. We did kind of a string arrangement and a horn arrangement on this one, that we were kind of going for a Beatles type vibe. And we're really, really happy with the way that it came together. It has kind of a really thoughtful intro and then just big sing-along chants through it.
So with the arrangement, how many strings are we talking about?
Well, the arrangement on that recording is all MIDI. So
okay.
It's...
If you were going to do it live, though.
If we were going to do it live, it would probably be a 16-piece orchestra.
Wow.
So
that'd
we
cool.
actually do have the Immerse Festival coming mm-hmm. up where we're playing with, I believe it's 24-piece. We're playing with the Orlando Philharmonic, has written arrangements for two of our songs. And they've joined with the Florida Youth Symphony, and they are backing us on two of our songs where they've written full string and horn arrangements. So we'll be doing that on October 18th downtown, the Chase Plaza Square, with the Immerse Fest, and that's going to be a lot of fun. We heard the arrangements for that, and that's going to be it's exciting. It's exciting.
It must be nice to be able to perform and have that volume of instruments behind you, right? But that's kind of a luxury that you probably can't afford mostly.
Yeah, well, this is like what dreams are made from, you know, like this idea of what's happening for the Immerse.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also because then they're adding things to it that weren't even on the record or you never even came up with. So it's just their creativity on top of what they've already heard what your product is. And so there's been some lines where I'm like, oh, man, I wish I could have thought about that, you know, written that. But mm-hmm. it's really neat to hear it.
Well, White Tigers.
With Y's instead of I's.
Yeah, tell us about that as well.
Well, why? Because our last name is Wynn, mm-hmm. and it's spelled with a Y. So we changed the I's to Y's in White and Tigers, because our name means pale in Gaelic originally. So it's
really?
Like white as in pale tigers.
So Wynn is pale.
Wynn means pale, yes, as you can see. we live up to it. But also, it's just an easy way to Google it. If you type in White Tigers with I's, all sorts of terrible things come up.
sure.
So White Tigers with Y's is only us. Mm-hmm. And that was just another branding choice that made it easy.
And you're from a pretty well-known musical family in Orlando?
Yeah. The Winds. My brother and sister, they play. Our sister-in-law, Hannah Harbor, she plays. I believe mm-hmm. you've had her before.
Yes, indeed.
And our dad, Tom Wynn, he's in the Country Music Hall of Fame. So we come from old school Orlando musician stock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Heather's grandpa, he ran the first integrated band in Orlando. He was
really?
The band leader of that.
Mm-hmm. What was the band?
Oh, I don't know.
It was like a jazz yeah. band back in the 50s, 60s.
Hmm.
He was the drummer and the mm-hmm. band leader. So, you know, we've been around and just doing our own take on it.
And it sounds, Heather, like you're raising the next generation of musicians too, right? With the
yes.
creating those songs, the car sing-alongs.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, and even with my kids, you know, it's like they're already starting on ukuleles and pianos and drums. And so it's neat to see that, how they, what they're, you know, going towards, what kind of music mm-hmm. they're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Like our oldest is now really into Wolf Peck. You know,
right? Wolfpack and musicals.
And though, musicals.
We went and saw a Broadway yeah. show, and I mean, just they
does
memorize lines, hearing it one time. Or we go to Disney, mm-hmm. and they know all the words to every musical. It's great.
Heather Lee and Jordan Wynn, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah,
thanks for
thank
having
you.
Us.
And to take us out, White Tigers with a song called "Love Story."
Bows bows and arrows round me. So all you got, I don't need. Gonna keep my eyes lifted high. Cut loose all that binds us. This ain't no love story. It ain't the truth.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Elizabeth Gondar. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening. Cross me a fire.